Thank you. My name is Rich Collins with the University of Alaska, and the talk is Pan-Arctic Study of the Coupled Tropospheric, Stratospheric, and Mesospheric Circulation. It's a project we put forward initially as a coordinated chain of LIDAR sites, laser radar sites across the Arctic at Poker Flat. I'll show a map in a minute. Alamar, which is the site in northern Norway, the Advanced LIDAR Observatory for Middle Atmosphere Research, Pearl, the Polar Environment Atmospheric Research Lab in Eureka, and the Sondastrom Upper Atmosphere Research Facility. And around that chain of middle atmosphere LIDARs, we've brought Lynn Harvey and David Atkinson, who are interested in using reanalysis and a synoptic view of what's happening in the Arctic in terms of the vortex and the anticyclones, Corey Mizutani, who is involved with the LIDAR work in Alaska, and Ruth Lieberman, who's bringing satellite saber analyses to bear in the project. So what I'd like to do is say something about the goals of the project, then talk briefly about Rayleigh LIDAR. I don't know, not too much stuff, but just an overview for everybody so they have an overview of what it is. I'd like to highlight some of the SPARC studies that have been based on Rayleigh LIDAR, and then just talk specifically about the project and what we hope to do during the next 2 years of the International Polar Year. Our scientific goals, as laid out in a proposal to the United States National Science Foundation, is to conduct what I would call a traditional JGR-type study of having a chain of LIDARs across the Arctic measuring temperature in the temperature profiles in the mesosphere and stratosphere. So, what I would call an aeronomical study or a traditional JGR multi-site study, looking at the temperature structure. And using the geographic distribution to ask synoptic scale questions about the vortex and the anticyclones in the Arctic, and hopefully get some monstrous stratospheric warming in the next 2 years that really perturbs the system and that we can document it well for the IPY. I don't know how the IPY has been cast in other countries. In the United States, the call for proposals with the IPY, with the NSF, wasn't quite a traditional call for proposals. There is an overlay of meeting very specific IPY goals about dissemination of science, about documentation, and for us in the mesosphere, finding those connections to human impacts, because in the United States, as I believe in Canada, the IPY isn't the IGY your advisor knew 50 years ago. It has a strong overlay of, if in Alaska, in some terms, civil rights issues around global climate change. And people are expected to address those and speak to those. So it's not the IGY your grandparents knew in that sense. And to determine our ability to forecast weather events in the troposphere, David Atkinson and Lynn Harvey were particularly interested in looking at coupling and seeing if we could use the LIDAR data to make any kind of forecast about tropospheric weather. And then to study coupling between anomalous stratospheric weather and tropospheric modes of variability during the IPY. The data and measurements that we bring together, and after this most of the slides are pictures. High resolution Rayleigh LIDAR measurements, 500 meters depending on the signal levels, tens of minutes temperature profiles of the stratosphere and mesosphere, meteorological analysis from the various national meteorological offices, satellite data from MLS, from ACE, and from SABER, and then focused on wintertime and springtime observations in 2007, 2008, and 2008 and 2009. And the sites are Poker Flat over in Alaska, Pearl in Nunavut, what's the island? It is Ellesmere, thank you. I get that confused, that's Baffin, right? Greenland, obviously, with Sondastrom at Kangerlussuaq, and Andøya, which is on the Alamar, which is on the island of Andøya. And mentally, of course, we have this picture that in the Arctic, we have a kidney bean vortex sitting in this region that drifts out across the Arctic, never really makes it to Alaska. Sometimes in March, there are vortex remnants that have been looked at. And, of course, there have been various studies. I suppose in this audience, I would highlight the study by Tom Duck and co-workers looking at the temperature structure in and out of the vortex and looking at the modulation of gravity wave activity and looking at the linkages between the stratospheric vortex and gravity wave driving as the vortex sort of swung out and forward over Eureka and back again. And so our goal was to say, okay, these sites would be the sort of the vortex-rich sites, where we expect to find the vortex. The Aleutian High would be out here, and as we'll see, we have some animations from Lynn Harvey's work showing that sort of interplay of what we expect the synoptic scale circulation to do and then the LIDAR to bring to bear underneath those different regimes. So I just want to say a bit about Rayleigh LIDAR. Rayleigh LIDAR, it's a laser laser radar. This is echo strength with height, an integrated echo showing the decay with the atmosphere with height, and we're just assuming that essentially it's a density profiler. And then under the assumption of hydrostatic equilibrium, we work out a temperature, given a seed temperature at some upper altitude. In this particular example I just highlight, we also get Mie scatter, which in this case would corrupt the measurements. These are Mie scatter from non-translucent clouds. And then in the lower altitudes, we throw everything away to the disdain of my tropospheric colleagues, because we don't want to overload our detectors. We're maintaining our sensitivity in the measurement through the stratosphere and mesosphere. And we turn that into temperatures. For example, here, this is an example of two-hour sequenced temperatures, integrating the echoes for 2 hours and looking at the temperature evolution in January 14th and 15th of January 2003. The thing about the LiDAR that you can do is the echo strength, I just want to point this out, the signal integrity is proportional to the echo strength. And so where you've got very stronger echoes lower down, we could actually look at this data at 15-minute resolution and actually do gravity wave studies and look at, and we hope to do this during the IPY, look at the modulation of gravity waves under different synoptic regimes in the middle atmosphere. But if you want to maintain the integrity of the measurement all the way up through 40 to 80 kilometers, then you've got to integrate your temperature profile for about 2 hours, because it's an integration method coming from above where the method is weakest. And I just want to point out some places where Rayleigh LiDAR has contributed to, I guess, the SPARC community. And the most famous middle atmosphere result from Rayleigh LiDAR is the Haute-Provence result of Chenin, Hochkorn, Kekut, and colleagues, where they have seen a statistically significant cooling trend in the 60 to, well, throughout the whole mesosphere at mid-latitudes. And this is a series of papers over about 15 years, and I think would be one of the highlights in middle, certainly one of the highlights in middle atmosphere LiDAR science in terms of this, how they came to that, those results, their discussion of looking for trends in summer versus winter because there's so much variability in the winter, the questions of instrument integrity and all that good stuff. And this was it's been highlighted in its own right, in its own publications, but highlighted in the Review of Geophysics article in 2001, where I'm looking at stratospheric temperature trends. I also just want to point out the comparison that's just been submitted by, coordinated by Bob Sika, to look at comparisons with the ACE satellites. And here are just, the red is ACE, and the black is LiDAR at Poco Flat. The comparison isn't perfect, but these are close overpasses within 200 kilometers and within 500 kilometers. There's a lot more going on in January, even in just the individual vertical profiles, but both the satellite and the LiDAR pull out mesospheric inversion layers that they see at the same time and the same general stratospheric structure. And that comparison has been done all over the globe where LiDARs are available, from Purple Crow here in Ontario. These are, I believe, summertime and early fall, where there's a lot less variability in the profile. And these are from Kulumsborn in northern Germany, the Institute of Atmospheric Physics group, again, making comparisons. And as I say, there's a big comparison paper that has just been submitted. And I just want to say that we have comparisons with SABRE, just to show how well we agree on a given day with SABRE measurements. SABRE, the measurement's about 270 kilometers from Poker Flat over interior Alaska, and we pull out all the same features, and we do actually pull out the mesospheric inversion layers and get very good agreement at the stratopost. This represents 2 hours of LiDAR data integrated, and this is just an individual SABRE sounding. So, just to say something about our observations in the Western Arctic, this is our climatology, and the reason I want to do this is because there's been a lot of work in the Eastern Arctic sites, and I just want to point out just some differences we seem to see. This is just, we've taken our nightly profiles, averaged them within month bands, and just produced a false color middle atmosphere that doesn't look terribly surprising. The stratopause is warm in summer and colder in winter, and this marks the height of the stratopause, and cools, obviously, in the mesosphere. If I look at the variability in those measurements, here are our January measurements, and I just want to point out you do get days where the stratopause, in inverted commas, appears in the high 60-kilometer region as a nightly average. There's masses of variability in January. There's significantly less variability in March. And I compare these two because they got similar numbers of samples, and so the RMS is reasonably meaningful to compare. That you've got about twice the RMS in the winter. And then in April and December, again, you've got about twice the RMS, but curiously, in December, we have this very small amount of variability at about 60 kilometers compared to what we see in the mesosphere above and the stratosphere below. But it gives you an idea of the, and in April, and this is typical of also in August, we just see rock-solid lack of variability. These would be indicative of night-to-night variability at this high latitude site. And to compare it to the spark climatology, we're generally colder. This is the zero line in the comparison. This is where we're warmer than spark. This is where we're colder than spark. We're generally colder. And if we compare ourselves to single site, and this represents a comparison with the zonal average reference atlas, if I look at the comparison with Rayleigh LIDAR sites in the eastern Arctic, we also tend to be colder. This is the zero line. This is the LIDAR climatology published in the AGU monograph, Science Across the Stratopause, by Gerard et al. From Sandstrom. So we appear to be, there does seem to be some drift across the Arctic that we are somewhat colder than comparable sites to the east of us. And we're colder than, climatologically, than the zonal average. So what we're doing for the IPY is, Lynn and Ruth and I didn't really want to come to the meeting and say, well, it's going to be great when it starts. We take measurements in November, and by the way, that's 8 weeks away. So what we've done is, Lynn was part of the SOLVE mission in 2003, looking at ozone with flights out of Kiruna. And so what we did is we took 2003 when we had dense LIDAR and we said, okay, let's put together a representative set of data for what you might expect us to be producing as we go into the IPY in 2007-2008. And so 2003 is not the exciting 2005-2006 year that everybody's been talking about, unfortunately. But these are just the NSEP averages, the minimum temperature from 50 to 90. In 2002-2003 is the red line, 2001-2002. I presume everybody's familiar with these kind of plots. But there is this minor warming, relatively, in mid-January through February. And so if we look at Sabre, Sabre yawed back into the northern hemisphere for us on the 16th of January that year, and you can see a warming, and then doing a gradient wind analysis, there's a reversal of the winds during that time in 2003. And if we look at that period, at the kind of analysis that Lynn would be doing, and our goal during the IPY is that Lynn would be producing these plots every day from reanalysis, or with GS4 maybe four times a day, and averaging out tides maybe, showing the structure of this, the vortex and the Aleutian high-pressure system as they rotate around each other in mid-January, and that there seems to be mixing between the air masses by the time you get to the 22nd, 23rd of January, a week later. There seems to be significant evolution of the vortex in that time. And if I look at LIDAR measurements during that time, where I had, if I go back, the vortex relatively well stacked with an Aleutian high just sitting there in just sort of a two system like that. The LIDAR sites were looking from, I guess, the eastern Pacific. There would be Poker Flat making measurements through that volume or under that volume. You see significant evolution in the LIDAR data. Now, what I've done is I've just shown the MSIS comparison, the mass spectrometer, an incoherent scatter climatology that's the extension of SIRA that's available on the web just for comparison, and show that its zonal average is way off, particularly by the 22nd of January when we have big excursions in the mesosphere. And if we look early, and if we go back to the 8th of January and we just look at the geopotential heights courtesy of David Atkinson, and just look at the scalloped pattern at the red is 5,400 meters geopotential height, 500 hectopascals, and see the scalloping associated with planetary wave perturbations in the troposphere, and assuming that they propagate on upwards through the mesosphere and link into the other data that I've shown you. We have a website, as mandated, showing the general layout, the maps. The idea is that through the IPY, we have animations, and I'll show you one of the animations to give you a feel for Lynn's animations at the end by clicking on the stratosphere, mesosphere, and that we would make the LIDAR data available. In 2003, as our prototype, we're just showing LIDAR data from Poker Flat, but we have I wouldn't say negotiated agreements. We have agreements with Alamar and Pearl and Sandstrom to put nightly average temperatures on the web as much as we can get them during the period. And the caveat, of course, is that LIDAR is, of course, the most exciting way of looking at the middle atmosphere if there are no tropospheric clouds above your head. If there are, it's a rather boring way of looking at the mesosphere. But that is to provide people with, through the period, and hopefully that we can coordinate a response if there is a major stratospheric warming event during that time and make the data available to others. We are committed to archiving the data with some kind of web-based portal by the University of Alaska. University of Alaska in Colorado will create a virtual observatory, and I say virtual observatory in quotations. Host institutions will also make the data available to the community databases like CEDAR, and we are working with the National Science Foundation in the United States has sort of puzzled over how to take what they funded as a disparate set of NSF proposals, everything from oceanography in the Arctic Basin to native village-based science in the Bering Straits to LIDAR studies of the mesosphere, and somehow bring this together in an integrated presentation to the taxpayer and to school children and everybody else who wants to see it as the IPY bundled together. And so there's a lot of work going on. One of the challenges is, and I think it's probably a challenge for a lot of people in ground-based geophysics, is that when you talk about creating cyberspace environments for geophysics, you talk to people whose idea of cyberspace is supercomputer simulations and creating virtual realities out of supercomputer simulations, not out of sparse networks of floating buoys in the Arctic Ocean that somehow need to be in the same environment as mesospheric LIDAR observations and native ways of knowing from the Bering Straits. So there's a complete culture gap between the people who are going to implement this cyber infrastructure and the people who are actually making the observations at the ground. And so the National Science Foundation in the United States is putting a lot of effort into working out how they're going to do this credibly. Our international collaborators, John Dragomir at the National Weather Service in Fairbanks, they are committed to the extent of they're very interested in seeing the data as it happens, and they're members of the National Weather Service staff who want to remain in the loop through the thing and see if we can actually catch any precursors of tropospheric events in the stratosphere. Peter Fox, who is a cyber infrastructure person at NCAR with the Arctic Observing Network. Greg Heinzelman is at SRI running the LIDARs in Greenland. Lubkin at IAP in Germany running Alamar. Mizutani working with us at Poker Flat. And Bob Sika is working with the LIDAR at Pearl. So that is the only other information I want to give. Our website, which will be working through the IPY. We're a component of IPY Spark and IPY EOSA. We're also interested, Rolando Garcia and Han Li Lu are interested, of course, in using the IPY data sets as benchmarked data sets for looking at WACM runs during the IPY and using it as data for that. We're funded by the Office of Polar Programs. There is no, again, in the National Science Foundation of the United States, there was no IPY directorate or anything created to administer the IPY. Everything was done through the Office of Polar Programs, and I'm the contact person. That's the talk. What I wanted to just show was give you an idea of the animations that Lynn has put together of what we would have on the website through the year. And I can just let that run. This is September 02 through May 03. And so it'll click forward here in a minute and get to January and get to the interesting stuff, but it has a life of its own. I can't fast forward it. So with that said, I'll take any questions, and people can admire the animation in the question time. Thank you. No. The short answer is no, but let me at least explain why. All of these are broadband Rayleigh LIDARs. They have not been configured for what I would call the two orders of magnitude work to go from making measurements at nighttime to making measurements at daytime. And obviously at Kulansborn, the IAP has done huge work to do that at that site. But I don't think the Rayleigh LIDAR at Alamar is not a routinely daytime LIDAR system. The studies of noctilucent clouds, where you've got strong backscatters, it works, but it's not going to pull out the molecular scatter at 80 kilometers in broad daylight and turn it into, I think, statistically significant temperature. So all these systems are nighttime systems. If you look at the Saber comparison, you'd say, well, Saber's doing it 15 times a day, why bother? And so the question is to get in the winter, as long as we can at nighttime, and look at both the high frequency evolution as well as the mean state for each day. Well, I'd like to say that we are going to be coordinated, but I mean, the fundamental limitation is how often do you have clear skies extending from Norway to Alaska on any given night in the Arctic winter? And so we do plan to coordinate in the sense of attempting to coordinate with regular communication week to week to week, which is not something we normally do. Normally we all just run in a free-running mode. So we are sort of guaranteed ongoing measurements at all sites, with some attempting to make denser measurements, but always inside the limitation of just, well, what does the actual weather do to, you know, how does the weather impact the observations? So I'd say we will be more coordinated than we would normally be, but not perfectly coordinated. Okay. Well, when we put this together, we hope so. That was our intention. We have people saying, well, there are resonance LIDARs at Alamar, why aren't you integrating those? There are airglow instruments across the Arctic, why aren't you integrating those? And we said, no, inside the package of a single proposal to NSF that has any hope of being coordinated, we wanted to say, no, we're going to stick with a single technique and our goal is to attempt to characterize oranges and oranges from different sites and not apples and oranges from different sites. Because a lot of people in the cedar community looked at this TED and said, well, why didn't you include the huge plethora of cedar stuff that's everywhere from Resolute Bay all the way across to Svalbard? And we said, having submitted the proposal, we want to put our efforts into making sure that the LIDARs are all consistent across the sites, and we're not in these papers where you say, well, you know, here were the geophysical variability, and here's the instrument variability, and somewhere here's the geophysics.